Okay, now we're going to hear from Peter Kell, who's going to give us an ASIC regulatory update. So Peter probably needs no introduction either, but he's been Deputy Chair of ASIC since 2013, and he was Commissioner from 2011. Prior to that, he was Deputy Chair of the ACCC and has had a very distinguished CV, which I won't read out in the interest of time. But Peter's going to be talking to us today about meeting community expectations which go beyond the letter of the law, challenges particularly for life insurance and insurance in super, prioritisation of customer outcomes, and the need to engage with regulatory reform. So all very topical in the current environment. Please join me in welcoming Peter Kell.
How are you? Good to see you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak to you today. These are obviously the two most exciting sessions, the regulator sessions. Great to be following Helen. Might say at the outset that ASIC and APRA are increasingly working together across the range of our responsibilities. We realise that that is an expectation that the industry has. We realise that that is an expectation that the community has, that the two regulators ensure that they work very closely together. And you see that in some of the joint projects that we're currently undertaking. I might mention one or two of those a little later in my speech. I want to talk to you today about four related topics. I'll cover them relatively briefly, but they all raise issues, I think, that confront all of us, industry and regulators. The first is the current environment that the financial services industry is facing, the trust deficit and the ongoing reviews and what that means for standards of conduct. The second is the focus of some of our work in the life insurance area across the different channels and also in claims handling. The third is just to briefly touch on some of the opportunities for financial services firms and the industry as a whole to take action to improve consumer trust and confidence, to strengthen codes, for example. And finally, I'm going to touch on some of the regulatory reforms that are coming down the track, we hope are getting closer, and what they might imply, regulatory reforms to ASIC's powers. So, as the new ASIC chair, Jane Shipton, said last week in a speech, the financial services industry as a whole is suffering a significant trust deficit in the eyes of the community at present. And as I'm sure you all appreciate, the industry was already subject to wide-ranging reviews before the announcement of the Royal Commission, and I hardly need to explain to this audience that this scrutiny has now significantly increased with the Royal Commission. And in ASIC's view, the Royal Commission is doing very important work in highlighting the costs and consequences of financial services misconduct. I'm not going to attempt to provide a commentary or to predict where its recommendations are going to land. But many of the instances of misconduct before the Commission to date have been the subject of ASIC investigations or are the subject of ASIC investigations or regulatory outcomes. And so we've been pleased that the importance attached to addressing these concerns has been very much underlined by the work of the Commission. But as well as focusing on actual misconduct, breaches of the law, the Royal Commission is highlighting the importance of community expectations and community standards. And I think what we've been seeing, and certainly this has also been highlighted by ASIC in several recent reports, is that an approach to your business which involves a minimal or technical compliance with the law can be very counterproductive. It at times has been allowed to override considerations of fairness and considerations of good consumer outcomes and indeed, I would argue, good business outcomes. And the message is that the financial services industry as a whole needs to ensure that your conduct and your products take into account issues around community expectations and fairness, as well as looking at the technical legal requirements. This, for example, was an issue that ASIC highlighted in its review of life insurance claims handling about 18 months ago. We found, for example, that there were inconsistent approaches to the issue of ad hoc payments, where claims may have been able to be denied purely on a legal analysis, but on any question of fairness ought to have been paid. And there were very inconsistent approaches, not just between firms, but within firms, leading to reputational damage, but more importantly, very poor consumer outcomes. So the community expects that the services you provide will be beneficial, have value, and that they will focus ultimately on good outcomes for the end user, the consumer, or the small business, as we're hearing this week. I'd now like to turn to ASIC's work in the life insurance space, and just to briefly give you a sense of how broad that is. And in many ways, our work here and the recent additional focus we've had on this area has arisen because of some of these issues, not just around misconduct, but around wider community expectations. Life insurance is obviously a fundamentally important product for consumers. It helps them to manage risks and to deal with major financial stress. But it's clear that in a variety of areas in the life insurance sector, consumer expectations have not been met, and there have been perceptions of poor practice and at times the reality of poor practice. And as a result, the sector is under unprecedented scrutiny. We've been working across the three major channels. In the advice channel, we conducted a review a few years ago, pointed to poor quality advice, and there have been substantial legislative reforms to remuneration for advisors on life insurance that were introduced in January this year following from that review. We found that conflicts of interest in remuneration were impacting on the quality of advice. We've been undertaking follow-up work in this space, cooperating with the industry on a data-gathering exercise, the collection of data on higher lapse rates from insurers to help identify potentially higher risk advisors, and we've already had several enforcement actions against problematic advisors as a result of this work. We'll be undertaking a follow-up review of the introduction of the regime in a few years' time. In the direct insurance space, ASIC is well into a major review of sales practices and consumer outcomes. Our decision to look more closely at this space was generated in part by our finding of higher claims denial rates in this channel, which suggests that too many consumers were ending up with products that they didn't understand or that were not good value for them. And it's also an area where we have found some poor practices around pressure selling, and we've had some enforcement actions there in recent times. We'll report on our findings in the second half of the year. That report, as well as looking at, if you like, the practicalities of the sales process, the disclosure to consumers and so on, we'll also be looking at some of the cultural indicators within firms, the way in which remuneration and incentives are provided, the way in which complaints are dealt with, so on and so forth. On the third major channel, we also have a focus on insurance in super, which is obviously a hot topic at the moment. We've been looking further into the initial results we published last year in our report on member experience of superannuation, which wasn't exclusively about insurance, but there were some issues in the insurance area that we've wanted to follow up. Now, insurance in super can and does provide very substantial benefits to many members. But our findings also indicate areas where improvements can and should be made, where the consumer experience of insurance in super needs to be improved. And the issues we've been seeing include that too many super fund members don't understand that they even have insurance cover, and don't understand how they might go about claiming or they could claim, that the claims process can be very difficult and time-consuming and documentation-heavy, and we've seen instances where people are bounced back and forth between different players in that process. We've also seen at times that people's retirement savings can be eroded by insurance premiums, and this is obviously an issue of debate at the moment. Finally, sitting above our look at the three channels is our ongoing work on the issue of claims outcomes and claims handling. As I said, we published a report the latter part of 2016, Report 498, and we found in that around 90% of claims are paid in the first instance, which is very important. But there was still work to do. So for TPD policies, some insurers had much higher rates of declined or withdrawn claims, and TPD represented a high proportion of all life insurance claims disputes before the Ombudsman. We also, as I said, found high lapse and decline rates for direct life insurance. One of the key results coming out of that work was a clear need for much more transparent data, better quality data, more consistent data on claims outcomes. And this is the subject of a major joint project by APRA and ASIC, which is ongoing, the development of a public reporting framework for insurance claims outcomes. On the issue of consistency, to give you an example as to why we found that challenging at the time, we found insurers that across the different policy types would have the highest claims denial rate for one type of policy across the industry and then perhaps the lowest claims denial rate for another type of policy. We found insurers that had in one type of policy the lowest claims denial rate, which might seem from a consumer perspective to be a good thing, but they had the highest claims withdrawal rate, which obviously led to the conclusion, which I'm sure many in here could understand, that things have not even been categorised consistently within firms, let alone across insurers. The issues identified by ASIC in the insurance space more generally, and also identified by other stakeholders such as the PJC, some have already led to law reform, such as the issue I've mentioned around remuneration for life insurance advice. The government has also committed to looking at further reforms, such as removing the exemption for claims handling from the consumer protection provisions of the corporations law. But it's also important to ask, while there's a focus on law reform, but it's also important to ask, what can industry itself do to help improve outcomes? What can industry itself do to help rebuild trust? What steps can you and your colleagues take to address some of the issues that are being highlighted by the regulator or in inquiries or by the community? After all, within our regulatory system, the first line of ensuring compliance and the fairness of financial services rests with firms themselves, rests with the licence holders that operate in our system. Now, one important point here that I'd like to highlight is that there are two perspectives when it comes to how you might go about improving interaction with customers. The first one at times predominates. What can my individual firm do? How can we better ensure that we're meeting the needs of consumers? The second perspective is, what can my industry sector do to help lift standards? It's my view that a disproportionate amount of poor conduct and poor consumer outcomes arises because of an inadequate interaction between these two perspectives. Notably, we too often confront the excuse that I can't change poor practices in my own firm because everyone else in the industry is doing the same thing. This has always been a poor excuse, but I think it's clear it is no longer acceptable at all. So that collective action issue that, oh yes, we realise that these incentives we're providing to the sales force are problematic and are encouraging the wrong sort of behaviour, but look, others are doing it. That way of thinking has to change. To my mind, this means that the importance of cross-industry initiatives, and this is where organisations like the Actuaries Institute and others have an important role to play, the importance of cross-industry initiatives will only increase. So I'll briefly mention two examples of this, the recent codes. So the Life Insurance Code of Practice, developed by the Financial Services Council, came into effect on 1 July last year. Our direct life insurance review, which I've just mentioned we're undertaking, is including a review of sales calls following the implementation of the code. And we have observed some improved sales practices which appear to be linked to code standards. So codes can have a real impact. Codes can have a real impact if they're well designed fairly quickly. And that's a positive result. But we've also identified some areas for improvement with the code. The FSC is currently conducting a review with some early indications that they will think about seeking approval from ASIC once it is updated. And we would indicate that the code does need to be strengthened across a number of areas, including claims timeframes, product design and distribution, assistance for more vulnerable consumers, tightening some of the requirements around remuneration and bonuses, and the way in which serious breaches or serious problems are reported. We'll continue to engage with the FSC. We've had good engagement so far. We'll continue to engage with them through the course of the review to address these issues. In a similar vein, the development and commencement of the Insurance and Super Code, I think, was an important step in recognising the need for industry to take initiatives to address some of the problems in this area. So I said Insurance and Super offers benefits to many members, but there are some problems and some well-recognised problems in this space. It was good that the code made a first attempt at analysing premium caps to prevent benefit erosion. And the code also introduced tighter timeframes of 45 days for dealing with claims and complaints, which, given the timeframes that we've seen so far and the length of time that's involved that many consumers have to experience, that should considerably improve consumer outcomes in that area. The code also has the potential to introduce some clearer and more consumer-focused disclosure. Nonetheless, it has some significant limitations, such as its lack of enforceability and a very lengthy transition period. So we will want to continue to engage with the industry on that code. But both of those initiatives, I think, are foreshadow the sort of cross-industry work around raising standards that is going to have to be of growing importance across the financial services sector. I now wanted to come to two areas of regulatory reform which will, I think, encourage this approach and play an important part in addressing what I've referred to earlier as the trust deficit. And these are two areas of reform that go to broad obligations on the industry and also to ASIC's power, the design and distribution obligations and the product intervention power. The government, when announcing the Royal Commission, also made it clear that it would continue to progress the reforms arising out of the Financial System Inquiry, and ASIC certainly welcomed that announcement. And this included the product design and distribution obligations, the DDOs, as those of us unfortunately who are immersed in this now use that acronym, and the product intervention power. The product, the design and distribution obligations, the DDOs, will apply to issuers and distributors and would be imposed at the stage of product design and distribution. And there will also be requirements to look at how the product works over time after sale. Product issuers and distributors would be obliged to consider the type of consumer whose financial needs would be addressed by buying the product in question and the channel best suited to distributing the product. These obligations would, in ASIC's view, bring accountability, better accountability to issuers and distributors of products by requiring them to establish processes and controls for ensuring the products are designed for consumer needs and with consumers' understanding in mind and are marketed to an appropriate section of the population. This is, again, one of the sources of frustration that I think you can see playing out in current inquiries, including the Royal Commission. For too long, product manufacturers and distributors have pointed the finger at each other when something goes wrong. The design and distribution obligation makes it clear that responsibility lies across the supply chain. There will no longer be the opportunity to point to a salesperson as the cause of consumer losses by a product manufacturer, and no longer the opportunity to point to product designers and try and attempt to shift responsibility in that way. It's time for the industry to recognise that it is a collective responsibility in ensuring better consumer outcomes. That's what this reform clearly indicates. And to complement these obligations, the government has also consulted on a product intervention power for ASIC that would enable us to take certain types of interventions where a product is identified as creating a risk of significant consumer detriment. The government is still considering the scope of this power. ASIC certainly supports a broad and flexible power that will allow us to intervene in relation to the products across our jurisdiction, with a range of interventions allowed, including where, say, aspects of the product relating to the remuneration attached to it may be of concern. One of the important points to note, and it's a bit of a myth that's grown up around this power, is that it would immediately lead to the regulator banning a whole lot of products. Banning, I think, would be at one extreme, hopefully used very, very rarely. But there are a range of other possible interventions, ensuring that the product is only sold through distribution channels that enable it to get to the right channel, ensuring that it is more appropriately labelled and so on. With a flexible power, in other words, ASIC would be able to take the least interventionist approach possible in the circumstances, but one that gets the best sort of outcome. So we would encourage industry to start thinking now, if you haven't already, about whether your current product design and distribution systems will meet the new obligations and to ensure they're capable of producing good consumer outcomes. I'll touch now very briefly on one other issue before I conclude. As we can see, where products or advice fail consumers and things go wrong, if these issues are addressed quickly and effectively, then there is going to be much less pain for everyone, most importantly the consumer, than if there are long drawn out processes and a failure to really grapple with the issues. Partly as a result of this whole question, we've seen considerable focus on both internal dispute resolution within firms and external dispute resolution and a major reform process in that area. In recent weeks, the government has authorised the new Australian Financial Complaints Authority as a new single complaints handling body in the financial services sector due to start a little later this year in November. In the super space, we're seeing increasingly ambitious timeframes set for dealing with complaints. The super code has said 45 days, which is half of the current timeframe, I might note, of 90 days. So we'll be keen to see how the industry meets those standards and to work with them. as well as establishing the new complaints handling body, one other aspect of the reforms that hasn't been commented on so much is the collection and publication of IDR data from all financial services licensees. So mandatory firm-level internal dispute resolution reporting requirements are set out in the legislation, and this data collection will identify firms and will help improve transparency and accountability of firms' internal dispute resolution practices. Look, there is no doubt that insurers and super trustees at times have a difficult task of assessing challenging claims and disputes and the volumes of claims and disputes. But at the same time, the systems and processes provide important data and feedback for all firms around areas where you may need to improve, areas where your communication with consumers may not be up to scratch, areas where you can learn around ways in which you can make your processes more efficient, whether it's in product design or claims handling. So that will also highlight the community expectations point. Is your own internal dispute data, your own internal complaints data, telling you some blunt messages about consumer expectations that you are or aren't meeting? These are going to be not only questions that you'll be dealing with within the firm, but will be highlighted as part of a broader public reporting framework. To conclude, I'd also note that ASIC obviously has a very important role here to help ensure that these new reforms are implemented effectively and that we work with the industry to make clear our expectations, that we provide guidance that will assist you and support you to achieve the best outcomes for members and customers. But we will also take action where we see industry participants engaging in misconduct or failing to take the implementation of these reforms seriously. ASIC is also going to be increasing its focus on helping consumers to build their own financial capability. We'll be launching the newest iteration of the Australian Financial Literacy Strategy within the next few months, because clearly having better informed consumers within this environment will also improve outcomes. It's for financial services firms and you in this room to influence your workplaces and your organisations to positively engage with the challenge of dealing with these reforms, dealing with these changes, but more importantly, to keep in mind the challenge of meeting evolving consumer needs and community expectations. And I look forward to all of you taking up that challenge. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Given we started you a couple of minutes late, I know there's been a few questions come through, so we might just take a couple of minutes to put some of those to you. Here's an interesting one. Are some insurance products simply junk insurance and should they be banned outright? Ooh, controversial question.
That's a simple question.
You can say you don't want to answer it.
No, I'm just thinking the best way to answer it. Because I have, and we have labelled some insurance products as junk products in recent times. Some of you may know ASIC undertook a major piece of work looking at the add-on insurance products that were sold through car dealerships, consumer credit insurance, tyre and rim insurance, mechanical breakdown insurance, several others. Some of those products had, on average, claims ratios of 5 cents in the dollar. Now, if that's not junk insurance, I don't know what is. And if there are insurers out there where your insurance products consistently have that sort of outcome, 5 cents in the dollar, then you have junk insurance and you need to think very quickly about ensuring that that isn't sold anymore. And we've obtained $120 million so far in remediation for consumers due to the sale of extraordinarily poor quality insurance products through that channel.
Okay, might just finish with this one. Are there examples of where a DDO would clearly have avoided consumer pain?
Look, again, I'll go to an easy example. Well, easy but significant example. We took action a little while back now against a company called The Cash Store, which I hope no one in this room has had to have anything to do with. It was, at the time, Australia's second largest payday lender. Now, they were selling a whole lot of insurance there to customers, low-income customers who were unemployed and therefore were ineligible to claim. So large amounts of that insurance were being sold to people who, at the outset, were not eligible to claim. And it was being sold through channels where that sort of clientele, that low-income, vulnerable clientele, was highly likely to come through the door. So that might seem like an obvious example, but it was one that was in the market, and we obtained a civil penalty of around $19 million for that, and The Cash Store, which was a Canadian company, ended up leaving Australia. But that's one more obvious example where you hope that those sorts of things are being can be avoided in the future, and that any company with sensible design and distribution obligations would not be there in the first place.
All right, please join me in thanking Peter Kell. Thank you.